You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented Blade Runner. Watching it with me is Rich Johnson from The Football Attic. Hi Rich, how are you?
Hello mate, I'm not too bad, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, and thank you for coming back. We'll get clear the air now. This is the second attempt at recording this after a minor technology failure last time at my end. So we can call this the final cut, or the director's cut, or whatever you want.
Wait, is this one got narration on it?
We'll have some, but yeah, it depends how this tests. What was so special about this film for you?
Well, since we last recorded it, I can't remember anything about it, so this is going to be a very short podcast.
People are relieved.
Yeah, sorry. For me, I don't think I ever watched Blade Runner when it came out, mainly because, what was it, 1982, so I'd have been about seven. And I think the first time I ever saw anything of Blade Runner was, I think, basically, growing up, in my house, we didn't have a video recorder till I was 16 in the early 90s. So my mum and dad were not exactly like the people who would go and get your latest technology. So I kind of suffered in that respect. So the girls who lived across the road, they had a video recorder early in the 80s. And I remember distinctly them having Blade Runner. And I think we watched it. I don't know whether we paid attention to the whole thing or not. But I didn't really get it, obviously, not for the subtle nuances, but it was sci-fi and I was into Star Wars, so I quite liked it from that angle. And I'm trying to think, really, when I ever sort of came back to watch, I think it was probably when it was on telly one year, but it was odd because it was like one of those films that it held a special place for me, even though I'd never really seen it till much later. But now it's definitely one of my favourite films. It's just, I think partially because it's aged so well, it still looks absolutely fantastic, and it's just a really interesting story as well.
I'll admit first up that, we recorded this in July 2018. That was the first time, just before that, the first time I'd ever seen it, which I suppose for an 80s movie podcast is borderline criminal. And I did sort of have the usual discussion beforehand about, I was aware of there were so many different versions of it. But, I'm amazed I got through almost 40 years of my life without having ever seen it. And like you say, for a film that was that old, sci-fi in particular can age horrendously. And the fact that it's set in this year, we're recording now in 2019, it just looks amazing. The story, if you boil down to, away from the technology and away from the science fiction, it's actually quite a simple story about creatures trying to seek out life and them being hunted and so on. Could almost be a fairy tale in a different person's mind. But yeah, and having seen it since then, and I've recently seen the sequel as well, which came out, I think that was 2 years ago now. And that was, I suppose, an odd film. It looks so beautiful, but I'm still struggling to get my head around that one.
Oh, I loved the sequel. I was, when they said they were finally going to do a second film, I was very, very nervous with it, because there are so many times when they've sort of in recent years where they've tried to do a sequel to something or tried to reboot it. But I think the thing is, I think what's happened with a lot of them is they've been doing it for the wrong reasons. So they've been doing it to try and cash in on the legacy of something. And I don't really feel that Blade Runner 2049 was done for cashing in purposes, because it's such an odd film to cash in on. It's still, even now, although it's regarded as a classic, it still has a very sort of niche audience. It's not like a blockbuster or anything. It's not like Ghostbusters or anything where everyone's heard of it. Even now, you said like you hadn't seen it till last year. Most of my mates at work, albeit sort of younger than me slightly, probably by about 5 years or something, but it's like a bit, but they haven't seen it. And even that, it's one of those films, if I say Blade Runner, so many people don't know what I'm talking about. So it's one of those films that's become a classic, but not very well known outside of Blade Runner fans and, I suppose, film buffs. So I was very worried when they did the second one, but I think that the thing is, they treated it with respect, and I think they tried to actually make a sequel worthy of the original film. And I personally think they succeeded. I absolutely really loved the second film, and I think the casting was spot on, because again, when you say like Ryan Gosling, you kind of think, oh god, are they doing that for sort of like, to go for the pretty boy popular sort of thing? But the way he was, I'd not really seen a huge amount of Ryan Gosling's films before, and I just thought he was absolutely brilliant. He fitted it perfectly. I've got mixed feelings about Harrison Ford being in it. I think they could have easily done it without him, but obviously that was sort of fan service. But I can easily live with that. It's like the sort of, you know, the latest Star Wars films when they've had all the old characters in and then slowly killed them off in the first two films. But I really liked it, and like you say, it was absolutely beautiful. It was so gorgeous, and it was very slow as well. It was a very slow film, and I liked that because it was deliberately slow. It's like they didn't sort of speed anything up. They knew who they were playing to, basically. And it does crack me up when you see like reviews of it, and it's you know, kind of, oh, I was expecting an action film, and it was really boring. And you think, well, why were you expecting an action film, you moron?
Well, the first film, I mean, that, as you say, came out in 1982, and starring Harrison Ford, probably, I'd say, one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. You're coming off Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, Indiana Jones. You know, for him to stay in that sort of sci-fi world from Star Wars. But, I mean, this was such a different film. You know, Star Wars being the swashbuckling, ageless story of good versus evil. And Indiana Jones being this ultimate adventure. And here, this was where we see him, you know, what is probably now his default. Slightly grumpy, aged. You know, he's an ex... Was he an ex-cop, or sort of he's sort of retired from retiring?
Yes.
and they bring him back to hunt these replicants, which are essentially synthetic robots / people. And, you know, just that whole story. I mean, it's so amazing how they were looking 37 years into the future. And again, everyone had flying cars, and we had robots doing our bidding on off-world colonies. I mean, I know it was based on a book from... I mean, the book was, what, the mid-60s when that came out? You know, amazing that has aged so well.
But I think partly why it's aged so well is because, apart from the fact the actual visual effects were really good, I think partially because it wasn't... I mean, a lot of sci-fi in the 70s was all sort of like, you know, sort of shiny surfaces and, you know, jetpacks. And actually, there probably... Do you know what? There probably never has been a sci-fi film with an actual jetpack in it. I think the only one is Thunderball, but it's such a cliche. But it's like, you know, you look at things and everything seemed like really shiny and futuristic. And that's the problem. They're trying to go futuristic, which, as we've always seen with anything where you try and be futuristic, it's so wide of the mark, you know, so like by the time that time arrives, it just doesn't look anything like what people thought it was going to be. But Blade Runner didn't look futuristic. If you took away the sort of like the flying cars and stuff and the obvious nods to the fact that this isn't now, it could easily have been now, because it's so dank and it's chucking it down with rain most of the time, and it's in old decrepit buildings, and it just doesn't look futuristic, to use that term. You know, it looks decaying and everything else, so that's why it's aged so well, because it didn't actually look so futuristic at the time.
I'm sure if you go to Los Angeles now in 2019, there are huge parts of it that if you take away the neon, I think you'd see a lot of poverty and, you know, things like that I suppose are a little bit easier to perhaps predict. And there's nothing that ages a film like technology, but you still have similar screens in Piccadilly Circus, and that's a place I'd avoid like the plague.
Well, the funny thing is like the couple of things that do sort of tend to date it are where you have screens, and of course they're like, you know, old-fashioned CRT screens. But even then, you kind of get the feeling that it could exist in a universe where, you know, because everything is so crap in that universe and it's really run down, it's perfectly acceptable to think, actually, they might still be using this outdated technology. But again, that's the point. All the technology in it, apart from when you get to, say, like, Terrell Corporation, where everything's the cutting edge of technology, all the rest of the technology is looking really old. I mean, even the Voight-Kampff machine where they do the test on Leon at the start looks like some kind of steampunk thing, you know, and it's literally got a bellows in it, so it's a good way to have gone with it.
Well, as you say, I mean, the film opens essentially with one of the replicants who have escaped this colony and come back to Earth. And now this is Leon, who's being interviewed about, you know, various things. It's their method of assessing whether someone is a replicant or a human. Now, we find out later on that the average number is about 30 to 40 questions, isn't it, that I think they give as a rough estimate. You know, it's vague. They gauge it by their reflexes in their eyes, mostly, isn't it? When the questioner asks him about his mother, he immediately stands up and shoots him.
Yeah, let me tell you about my mother.
It's almost like there's missing a punchline for the world's first your mum joke or something like that.
But the thing is, I love about that. The guy that plays Leon is absolutely brilliant in that role. I absolutely love Leon. It's such a shame he's only in it for such a short period, because it plays it so brilliantly. I mean, he looks like a psychopath, you know, and they're obviously trying to suss out the replicants, and he's probably the least convincing in terms of being realistic because he's so odd. I mean, it's like when they're asking you about the, you know, you're sort of looking at a beetle or a turtle or something, and it's upside down in the desert and it's struggling. And he's like, going, why am I looking at it? You know, why is it there? And it's like, you know, totally not getting in the whole point of analogies and sort of hypothetical situations.
You know, again, like, going to be popping up in, I suppose, probably several of these podcasts. I mean, you know, he was in 48 Hours, Tango and Cash, but, I mean, Brian James, he was also in The Fifth Element. You know, and again, this is another film, I'm not saying a million miles away, but he did play that so well, and he was only in it really for a couple of scenes. You know, this part, there was a part later on when obviously he meets his demise, but he really didn't get a lot of screen time for, I mean, again, not the main villain, but yeah, he got snuffed out quite quickly. But yeah, he was he played really well as this sort of almost oafish character. Who is, I mean, I don't know, do they search these people for guns as they come into interviews? I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's you know, considering what they're supposed to be doing, you'd have thought that was kind of a basic security measure, really. But you know, they just didn't seem to. Maybe the scanner wasn't working because they'd run out of steam or something.
So Harrison Ford gets dragged back into this. He's off eating his Japanese food in the constant rain of Los Angeles. Now, his mission is, so there were six replicants on Earth. Two of them died en route, I think it was, or shortly after, but there were four to catch. And in order to find these out, he had to go and see the head of, I mean, again, this shows how in maybe the futuristic views that corporations were more important and powerful than government, which is pretty accurate, I suppose.
It's very prescient, that one, yeah.
And I suppose in this case he's gone to the head of the Terrell Corporation, which is equivalent to going to see Steve Jobs or something, and basically to meet one of his creations. And this is where we meet Rachel. Now, she's a replicant of... Now, she's a Nexus 7, which is the next one, because the ones who've returned to Earth are Nexus 6.
Yeah.
And because originally she doesn't actually know that she's a replicant. She actually thinks she's a person. And this is the whole sort of self-aware thing.
Well, that, yeah, because then there's that, the scene where he sort of basically tells her that, you know, all those memories are, I think it was Terrell's niece. And she gets really upset. And then, of course, he tries to make out like it's a joke, you know. But it's like, yeah, you kind of a bit late to pull that one back.
Oh, no, it's a joke, really. I didn't mean it.
Yeah. No, not those memories. Oh, I meant some other memories. No.
Oh, no, I was thinking of another woman replicant I've been seeing. But it took her about 100 questions for her to fail her sort of test, which is pretty good going, I suppose, if, you know, your average Blade Runner, and I suppose explain, Blade Runners are there to kill or retire these replicants who've escaped these off-world colonies. But, I mean, it's funny, because I always remember Sean Young from Ace Ventura, and she... And I'd never seen The Crying Game, and I guess there's a lot of things where she's playing people who aren't what they seem, maybe.
Well, I have not actually ever seen Ace Ventura, so yeah. That, you know what, there's a lot of films that, like, so many other people have, like, that just seem to, everyone seems to have seen them, and I haven't seen them. I mean, like, you mentioned Fifth Element before, I've not seen that either.
Okay.
But I have watched The Crying Game, but only in the last 2 years. I'd never seen it prior to that.
So as part of, Deckard, Harrison Ford didn't explain that. He goes investigating, basically he's chasing the samples that he gets, and obviously he's got the videotape of Leon's interview that's gone horribly wrong. And we meet Mr. Roy Batty, who sounds like a ne'er-do-well from Coronation Street, but he's actually he's actually sort of super villain, or well, it seems super villain in this anyway.
I love the fact that, like you say, the name Roy Batty, it just sounds like a sort of an irate butcher.
Played for Huddersfield Town in the 50s.
Yeah, had a leg injury in the cup final, never played again.
This is the only thing really that I mean, Rutger Hauer was, he was in so many films, and I always remember from the Guinness adverts and things like that. But I mean, in this film, and this is the point, or one of the points of the film, is that, you know, we meet him at the beginning where he goes to investigate the man who makes the eyes, because they have returned to basically find their maker. Now, these replicants only have a shelf life of about 4 years. So they're trying to find out what's going on. And he comes across as this malevolent, evil being who sort of, it shows, I mean, his character changes and develops so much. I mean, we find that out in the end. And certainly of the end of the final cut, not the fucking theatrical version, which leaves it deliberately vague. This was, I mean, this isn't one for the squeamish. There was various scenes of eyeballs and eyes being manipulated and, I mean, essentially being manufactured, but, yeah, not for the squeamish.
No. No, it's a bit grim. I think that was one of the things that when I saw the film for the first time as a, probably at like a sort of 9 or 10 year old or something at my friend's house, I think that was one of the standout scenes for me that kind of like really made an impression on my brain, a bit like Roy's thumbs did.
Oh, God. You've got, I mean, this sounds really weird. You've got Roy Batty and Leon go to interrogate, is it Chu or Chow? I can't remember.
Oh,
mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just sounds odd. It's like something out of the Dandy. And their only lead from them is to go and see J.F. Sebastian, who we'll meet later on, but it's, again, like a J.R. Hartley, something out of the Yellow Pages. So Rachel follows Deckard back, and this is where, as you say, he starts pushing her boundaries around the memories. This is when, obviously, he knows, she doesn't know, or originally doesn't know. And I suppose it is quite cruel if this person thinks she's a person. It's almost like telling someone Santa Claus doesn't exist. I mean, he does, obviously, but it's a bold move on his part to kind of to sow that seed. You know, she thinks she's real, she's not, and all of a sudden she like gets her a drink, and this is the start of a very strange little courtship that they have throughout the film.
Yeah, it's kind of like a sort of an 80s version of negging. It's like, but they do have a strange sort of relationship. I mean, like you say, he kind of almost, I think he's almost annoyed by the fact that she's so advanced, and he like wants to bring her down a peg, because she's not aware of it. That's his little power trip. He's got that power over her. It's like, well, she's this sort of amazing creation that apparently, like, Tyrell thinks is just, you know, kind of next level and just beyond humans to a degree. And I think he kind of views it very suspiciously and just kind of wants to bring her down. And you do wonder how much he actually is, you know, aware of whether he is a replicant or not at that point. Because it's never really cleared up whether he is. My personal opinion is he is. Because, of course, he has the unicorn dream a lot of the time. And then Gaff, later, one of the other characters, one of the policemen, he leaves the little origami unicorn in his apartment. So the hint there is obviously that, you know, you think that's your dream, but actually it's not. We all know this. And so I do wonder whether he's trying to bring her down because he doesn't... Because, like I say, he has maybe inklings that he might be a replicant, and obviously if he's a replicant, he's nowhere near as good as her. But then I think last time we actually talked about this, we mentioned the fact that there's a very, very, what would now be very uncomfortable scene, which I think we described as a bit rapey, and that's where sort of I'm trying to think, it was the same scene, I can't remember now, it's where he sort of is upset her, and then he sort of just basically forces himself upon her, and of course this being the 80s, she sort of resists a bit, and then just goes with it, you know, as you would, whereas now you watch that, and that's the funny thing, it's a really interesting thing, of all the things that haven't aged in Blade Runner, considering all the things that could have, you know, not aged well, it's the sort of social side of it that's the aspect that really, you kind of look at it now and you think, ooh, that doesn't sort of fit now.
It's a bit where he's sort of, you know, virtually saying, like, tell me you love me. And that, yeah. I mean, this is the thing, it's that, again, that's more of a, perhaps a relationship between, you know, we think possible replicant and replicant, or man and woman, or however that decides to go. It's odd because, you know, for years, I'd always heard, not that I'd seen the film and so it didn't quite register perhaps, but there were the tales of, is Deckard a replicant? Now, you know, from watching the theatrical version, the original cinematic one that came out of the cinema, this it's kind of implied that he's not. And yet, when you watch the version that's the supposedly the final cut that I've seen, it's implied that, yeah, he might be. And then I read something else last week where Ridley Scott has apparently told Harrison Ford, yes, you are. Or yes, you were.
Yeah, because Harrison doesn't like that, does he?
No. And then in the sequel, Ryan Gosling's character is made clear is a replicant.
Yes.
So it's kind of like, well, you know, at what point, you know, and I know this is the whole point, you know, again, I've had this discussion on other podcasts about, say, you know, how much should people be spoon-fed things and be given an opportunity to sort of have their own mind and think what they want. And again, it's like, you know, the Star Wars thing. You know, I keep going back to Star Wars, but, you know, with these latest films where they're like, well, why don't you tell us who so-and-so's parents are? I was like, well, you don't need to. Sometimes just have a think about it on your own. It's not relevant, whatever.
See, the funny thing is that a lot of things like that in films, I kind of always want to know. It's like, I mean, I'm one of those sort of people that watch a film, and if I really enjoyed it, you sort of think, but what happened next? You know, at the end of the film, you think, what did they do next? You know, what did they do the day after? And it's like, so sometimes I really like to be sort of, I have questions, and I think what it is, I just want to know. I want to know officially what it is. But I think I like the fact with Blade Runner, you never fully know.
Hmm.
And even in by the end of the second film, there's still no definitive answer as to whether he is a replicant or not, because we know Rachel was, so obviously in the second film, spoiler alert if you haven't seen a film that's 2 years old, we know that she had a baby, and so the whole point is like, oh my god, a replicant can have a baby, which is what Wallace, the guy in the sort of the Terrell figure in the second film, is trying to find. He's trying to master reproduction for replicants. But it still never said whether he was a replicant or not. So you don't know whether that child was human replicant or full replicant. So it's, but I like the fact that you don't fully know. It's very much hinted at it, but it's never confirmed.
You know, it's easy with hindsight, and you know there are what, 7 or 8 different versions of the film in various forms. Anyway, you know, with whatever footage has been filmed or made, it's probably quite easy to make it seem a different way through just a couple of cuts. The unicorn dream that you mentioned, for example, he's kind of awake during that. So it's almost like, is that like a downtime thing, or like a Windows is updating?
Yes, he's rebooting.
One thing I did like was the part where, you know, he's quite melancholy, and again, this is where he's investigating the photo that Rachel's left for him, and he's giving these voice commands to this computer that's, you know, it's like basically Siri, isn't it? Like, please enlarge, please enlarge.
Yeah.
This is where they find the lady with the tattoo, who turns out to be the
Zora.
Zora, yes. Oh, lovely Zora. I suppose that would have been an eye-opener for a lot of young men. And,
yes.
Yeah, finds the
More a fly-opener. Moving on.
Depends which version, I suppose. Because he's found a skin sample, of something anyway, and he goes to visit another brilliant named Taffy Lewis, who's, because it turns out to be snake skin, and obviously she finds that Zora is a dancer at a nightclub. His backstory into her dressing room, basically, you know, again, it's in looking with hindsight, it's, you know, making sure performers don't get exploited, which, of course, in those days, it was probably very much the opposite.
I'm from the Confidential Committee on Moral Abuses.
Committee of Moral Abuses?
Yes, ma'am. There's been some reports that the management has been taking liberties with the artists in this place.
I don't know nothing about it.
Have you felt yourself to be exploited in any way?
How do you mean, exploited?
Well, like to get this job. I mean, did you do or were you asked to do anything that's lewd or unsavory or otherwise repulsive to your person?
But the thing is with that scene as well is because, like, he is very much made out to be a real sleazy bastard in that scene. The thing I like about it as well, for many levels, is the fact that she's just getting changed right in front of him. obviously on a very base level, that's quite enjoyable to some degree for some reason.
To some
degree. But yeah, but what I do like about it is that she's very much the kind of, I'm in control here, this is my territory, you know, you're an asshole basically. And it's just, I love the fact that she just, you know, kind of gets changed completely topless in front of him as if to say, fuck you, basically. You know, it's kind of like literally just kind of, yeah, well, you're kind of coming in here pretending to be all for my welfare, and it's like, I'm just going to show you that I just think you're an absolute piece of crap on my shoe. And I love the fact that she clearly knows right from the start who, you know, what he is. Not necessarily a sort of Blade Runner, but she knows he's trouble. And she just sort of goes along with it, yeah, whatever, and then until she gets the opportunity to sprint. And sprint she does.
Oh, yeah, she flies, doesn't she? Cause, I mean, she gives him a couple of good wallops first.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, a lesser man may have crumbled or enjoyed it. But, I mean, we get a shortish chase. She's wearing what looks like a bra set from the movie Gladiator and a see-through Mac, and then runs through the Trocadero and gets shot a couple of times. And it's just... it looks so funny watching it now. You know, obviously a lot of it's slow motion and
yeah,
everything else, but you know, to see this, a man chasing a woman with a gun, sort of killing her, and it's all under the watchful eye of Leon, who's just standing there watching.
But it's like you say, that I think is probably one of the few scenes again that might have, you know, possibly aged not well, because it does look a bit cheesy. It's very 80s action flick, that is. The kind of the slow motion and the kind of crashing through the glass and everything, but it's and especially if it's like you say, a woman wearing a very sort of odd outfit, yeah, it's not aged well, that whole thing, but yeah, it's still good
fun. I enjoyed it as a grown-up man.
As a person who enjoys women being shot, it was great.
Yeah, one for the purists. Leon comes across Deckard, gives him a good beating. Basically, well, he's about to kill him, and up pops Rachel with a gun and does the business, shoots Leon dead. And this is when we go back to Deckard's flat, and when the slightly sort of awkward. That awkward scene. She goes back, and this is where she says,
I'm not in the business. I am the business.
And one thing I did notice the second time round of watching is there's a jazzy version of You're Just Too Good to Be True in the background. And I mean, that's got to be deliberate.
I hadn't honestly ever noticed that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I hadn't twigged exactly what the song was the first time round, and I was listening to it the second time last week, and I thought, wait a minute.
Yeah, I've just, you know, I'm hearing it in my head now, and I know exactly which bit you mean.
Yeah.
I'd never realised that's what it was, because I just, it's because of the soundtrack, which is sort of quite iconic in itself. I just never realised. I just thought it was another Vangelis song, or Vangelis, however you pronounce the name, I can't remember. But I just thought it was another one of his sort of typical saxy synth things. I hadn't ever realised what it was that.
Laying an Easter egg for us there. But yeah, this is the really odd, sort of, you know, it's like dirty talk, isn't it? It's like, tell me you want me to, you know, it's really weird.
Yeah, again, sticking out somewhat.
One bit we did skip over, it was... the arrival of Pris in Los Angeles. So we're talking 1982, Daryl Hannah. Wonderful.
Yes. Anyway.
I mean, I talked about Daryl Hannah when I did the Splash episode. There wasn't too much perving in that one, I think. But yeah, she's played as the... Was it the pleasure model, I think she's described as.
Yeah. I mean, let's be blatant about it. The pleasure model.
Now, she's already met J.F. Sebastian at his really odd little, call it a lair. He makes the toys, because he's described as a genetic designer. And he makes these toys, which are just, like, even creepier Oompa Loompas. But I didn't realise, again, it must have just passed me by, that he is also a replicant. But he comes across as, you know, quite simple. but it turns out he's 25 years old, but has, was it something where he grows old quite quickly?
Yeah, he's got some kind of disease.
Yeah, and Roy Batty turns up, and because they're trying to explain that they're these super advanced models, Pris reaches in to grab some boiling eggs. It must be a metaphor for something. And this is where, you know, they convince him to take him to Tyrell, the big boss.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I think I'm probably skipping ahead somewhat to the bit where Pris gets killed, but I needed to mention it while it's in my head, is that where she does all the backflips when she meets Deckard, that's a man in the actual... the gymnast who did that was a man. And they, and in some films, because it's moving so quickly, you don't really see it. But when they sort of show it in like kind of makings of, he's quite a muscular man as well. He's like, because Daryl Hannah's quite lithe and sort of slim, and he is not. He is quite well built. It's just bizarre, and he's got this really bad blonde wig on.
Is this like when you watch the final scene of Flashdance and you realise that one of the dancers in that is a bloke and still has a moustache, which you can see if you pause it in the right place?
Again, never seen that film, although I never intend to watch that because it's a film about lots of dancing. But I have seen the bit you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was in a Jennifer Lopez or something video. I don't think she had a moustache in it.
You never know.
I mean, and this is the thing, is they're showing J.F. Sebastian that they're these advanced models. And I know we talked about this before quite a lot, the sort of poetic part of the meeting between Roy and Tyrell. You know, essentially it's like meeting your creator, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the scenes as well where you kind of, you get to see, if you like, for want of a better word, the humanity in the replicants, and it's the first time you sort of feel sorry for them. Because, and Rutger Hauer plays it really well, considering Rutger Hauer is like a you know, built like a brick shithouse. And in this, you know, with his shock of blonde hair, he looks every bit the sort of psychopathic Nexus model that he is, you know, and the unstoppable killing machine always. But there's this brilliant moment of like I say, humanity, where he's practically, for, you know, really, he's begging Tyrell to give him some more life, and that's all he wants, is just more life, you know, and it's not for any nefarious purpose, he just wants to exist more. And it sort of, you know, right from the start, all of the replicants are portrayed as very villainous and kind of evil and bad, and then it turns, you know, you go back to Roy and he just wants to live more because he's jealous of humans that get to live, and to a degree he's like, kind of, you know, I'm an amazing creature and you lot are all very basic human beings, and you get to live as long as you want and I don't, and that's not fair, you know. And there's this great sense of injustice. I mean, there's a brilliant line where Tyrell says, what seems to be the problem? And Batty says, death. And Tyrell just replies, ah, well, that's a little out of my jurisdiction. And I think that's the thing. And that's the really poignant, sad moment for Batty, is when he realises that with all the strength that he's got, with all this sort of, you know, he can push people's eyes into the back of the head, but he cannot get what he wants. And there's nothing he can do about it. There is nothing Tyrell can do about it. Even if he wanted to, there's nothing he can do about it because he just doesn't have the answer. And it's that moment... I mean, he ultimately then kills Tyrell by, like I say, pushing his eyes into the back of his head. But that's, you know, that kind of where he switches back. It's almost like he let himself be vulnerable, and then it's like, damn, I've done that, and I didn't get what I wanted. And so then he just thinks, well, fuck it then, and just goes back to being, you know, the killing machine. Because at that point, Tyrell's useless to him. So he just thinks, well, why keep you alive? Why should you get to live?
Well, this is part where, you know, Roy obviously knows a fair bit around the science, because he does put these questions to Tyrell, and every question he puts to him, Tyrell does have an answer. He does have a supposedly logical explanation as to why that can't be done. And again, it's an issue that, you know, this isn't something where you can just recode things. Maybe it is, but this would be something you would do on a later model or a different version. It would be very difficult to make that Roy Batty suddenly become a different creature, a different thing, because essentially he wouldn't be him anymore. And I mean, he does have this sort of childlike, you know, he calls Tyrell father at one point, I think that was changed. One thing I read, I think he called him fucker in one of the first versions. And they changed it to father because it made it sound like more like you're meeting your maker.
Yeah.
But again, you know, if you go to that ultimate level of meeting the creator and he tells you that, you know, I suppose this is what I want. It's not even eternal life. It's just more than 4 years. Yeah, get less for get less for murder. And, you know, to be told, no, it's not going to happen. You know, this is where we see the psychopath, the killer, the evil thing suddenly realise, like, well, you know, you're almost having to completely rethink your outlook on life, or whatever you call that life, limited time on Earth, whatever.
I was going to say, it's an interesting insight into Terrell's character as well at that point, because Terrell is creating these amazing creations, and that's all they are to him, they're creations. He's very proud of them, and he does kind of treat them like his children, but at the same time, he's not bothered they're about to die. It's very strange, because he's like I say, he treats Roy, and he even calls Roy the prodigal son. So he very much sort of views Roy, other than Rachel is obviously his pinnacle, but I think he's still got this great sense of affection for Roy. And the fact that he's managed to, you know, get back to Terrell when, of course, he's just supposed to be off on, you know, an off-world colony somewhere slaving away. But at the same time, he doesn't have any sort of empathy for him. It's like he just thinks, well, that's life, you know. And I think the quote that I liked as well is he said, the light that burns twice as bright burns half as long, and you have burned so very brightly, Roy. So it's like he's really proud of him, but at the same time doesn't give a toss that he's about to just stop.
I suppose it's hard to feel empathy or even sympathy for essentially a non-human, you know, not a living being.
But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because it's like he to him, they're never human. It doesn't matter. Even with Rachel, she will still never be human. And to Terrell, although he's striving for this perfection, they still, whatever he does, it will never be a human. So he will never have that connection with it.
It's like Geppetto and Pinocchio. Just wants to be a real live boy,
but slightly less creepy.
Yeah, I don't think anything grows bigger if he lies. Maybe that's Deckard. And yeah, we get Terrell dies in the same way that the geezer does Inspector. I mean, one thing I did think was, because the opening credits of the sequel say that the Terrell Corporation went bankrupt because of the homicidal killing replicants, you know, and ultimately that what Terrell had created killed him physically, but also killed the company, which shows kind of the impact, really. And people in 2019 just, you know, they get offended by the smallest things.
Yeah, that was the problem. They were just so, like, offended by Roy's Roy's lifestyle choices.
These snowflakes, you know, they can't take these killing machines coming back and murdering people. What was wrong with them?
Yeah, all he did was push your eyes into your head. Come on.
Oh, it could be worse. I mean, the villain or the big boss in the sequel, he couldn't see either.
No, exactly. Mm. Who needs eyes? Come on. Come on, Terrell.
Just make some new ones.
To be honest, he probably also went bankrupt because he spent too much time in his crisp division. Oh, dear. Taxi.
After Terrell dies, Deckard goes to J.F. Sebastian's. He sees all the various toys and everything else. And this is where Pris and Stunt Double try to break his neck with her crotch, which I suppose now that we know part of it is a bloke, it's kind of spoils that, really.
Yeah, to be fair, I don't think that was a bloke at that point. I think the close-up, you'd have been able to spot the sort of the blokiness about it, I think.
I don't know, you said you've seen The Crying Game.
Yeah, but not that close.
Okay. She tries to break his neck with her crotch, very sort of Bondy sort of thing. He shoots her, and she dies horribly.
Yeah.
Ugh, what a death scene that was.
Yeah, I mean, in any other film, if that would have been, you know, the kind of it's almost like, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, if you'd sort of look on YouTube and stuff, you'd just like to see the worst movies ever. There's some brilliant ones from, like, on a kind of like Hungary or Turkey or something.
Oh,
where,
yeah,
people get shot and they, you know, kind of die in about 10 minutes and kind of just ah like this, and, you know, gone on. But yeah, her death scene is quite epic in that sense. You know, she sort of thrashes around for quite a long time. And apparently, I think she Well, I know that Daryl Hannah actually she chipped part of her elbow. But that not in that scene. That was the bit where she I think where she gets frightened by Jeff Sebastian and she runs off and slips and actually sticks her elbow through a window of a car. And that wasn't scripted. She slipped and did it and actually chipped her elbow. But just carried on with the scene. But I think in that bit, I think she ended up with like bruising all over because, of course, she was thrashing around so much.
Bloody hell. I was just thinking when you were saying about these sort of Turkish films that get remade, I understand, and this says a lot about, I know there's some Twitter accounts that I follow where they talk about films that are, I think there's one called Turkish Star Wars and Turkish Superman. Yes. And they're actually called, I think, Turkish Star Wars, where they are just lunatics. And I think the BBC website had a feature on them quite recently, just because they're so ridiculous that they have become this cult following.
I wonder if they ever did Blade Runner. I'd love to see if they did.
Turkish Blade Runner. Might have to try that one.
Yeah.
So Roy turns up as, he kisses Pris's dead body. Well, it's not really dead. Expired, retired, whatever.
Tired, yeah.
Yeah. And begins a strange fight, final fight with Deckard. He breaks Deckard's fingers through the wall and Deckard tries to escape. He pins the nail from the floor through his hand. I assume to get some sort of adrenaline rush or something like that.
I think it was also because his hands were cramping up because his fingers started to sort of curl. So I think it was like, yeah. I mean, those two scenes as well were, again, the scenes that stuck in 9-year-old me's head was the breaking of the fingers, like one for Pris and one for Leon. And then the second one, like you say, when he's sticking the nails through his hands, it's like, ooh.
Yeah. Even the watching the finger breaking, like, even recently, you just think, oh, God.
Yeah, and Harrison Ford plays that very well. You feel that what he is feeling in that scene.
Proud of yourself, little man. This is for Zora. Ah! This is for Pris.
Come on, Deckard. I'm right here, but you've got to shoot straight.
Yes, and, you know, at this point, we have to assume that Roy has started to die.
Yes.
You know, he needs this adrenaline to get going, and because his hand's cramping up, Deckard tries to escape, and this is where the sort of, I suppose, one of the scenes that a lot of people remember, even if they haven't, you know, loved the film and everything, where Deckard is trying to escape. He's hanging onto the building from outside in this pissing rain, and Roy just jumps across. You know, he's dying, but he's still sort of Superman. Can just jump across. And again, another hipster reference, Deckard's wearing an old sort of Casio digital watch, which in 2019 is still massively popular amongst certain communities.
I was going to say, almost every other day I get like an email from, like, I think it's 7 Days Shop advertising those exact Casio watches. I don't know, the ones I usually see, they've got the calculator on. I don't know if Deckard's had a calculator on it, but
They
were the dog's bollocks back in the day, man. You know.
I had a similar one that was a James Bond one that played the 007 theme.
Novelty watches were all the rage when we were kids. It were brilliant. It was a brilliant time. Said me, Roy Batty.
Now, this is the scene that gets, I suppose, one of the biggest reviews when it comes to the difference between the versions, because Roy saves Deckard. He says part of his sort of thing is he's looking down at Deckard, sort of grabbing on for dear life, and just saying it's quite an experience to live in fear, as though Deckard's fear is kind of driving him to push him on. And then as Deckard falls, Roy grabs him and pulls him up. And we get really, you know, from, this sounds weird, Rutger Hauer, great acting.
Yes. this, it's become one of those sort of, you know, iconic scenes. That, again, this is one of those things that even people who've probably never seen Blade Runner or necessarily heard of Blade Runner will probably have heard of this particular a scene, and especially the speech that he does.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain. Time to die.
But, and again, you made a really good point about the difference between versions, because, and I mentioned this last time we talked about this, and I'm going to read it verbatim. So, you bearing in mind that last scene is almost as good a perfect an ending to a film. Okay, it's not the very last scene, but you know what I mean, the end sort of climax to a film as you can ever get. Roy Batty doing his speech about, you know, he's seen things that people wouldn't believe and stuff like this, and again, hence why he wanted more life, because he's experienced these amazing things that the majority of mere mortals who are granted this, to him, almost an eternal life, you know, would never see, would never experience. Just, to him, they're just wasting your life, and here he is accepting that he's going to die, you know, and he gives this amazing speech. But in the theatrical cut, which I cannot, even to this day, cannot bring myself to watch, what happens is Roy dies, having given his amazing speech, and then some twat decided that they needed narration over this. So you've had this amazing scene, this perfect scene. All it needs is the bit where it fades out, he's there, they slow it down slightly, so the rain's just pouring slowly, and it fades to black. That's it. That's the end of that scene. Okay, there's a bit with Gaff afterwards, but that's the way that scene should finish. But no. Someone decided that the following dialogue should be played over this, and I'm going to try and read it in my best narration voice. So again, Roy Batty has just died. Emotional scene. I don't know why he saved my life. Maybe I'm talking to Hannibal Lecter.
I was about to say, it sounds like Morgan Freeman in The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah. I don't know why he saved my life that day. He says, I don't know why he saved my life. Maybe in those last moments he loved life more than he ever had before. Not just his life, anybody's life, my life. All he'd wanted was the same answers the rest of us want. Where do I come from? Where am I going? How long have I got? Well, he knew the answer to that one. And all I could do is sit there and watch him die. What? Just, I'm speechless at that utter wank.
It's a really odd thing that I know, and again, this film has been doctored and dicked around with as many times as bloody Star Wars, but that is such a huge change of pace and direction from, you know, the final cut to, or the one that people saw in the cinema, to what people mostly see now, unless you've got Sky Movies, which only has the theatrical version. But, and you could tell as well, I mean, you know, I'm not a professional actor or anything else, you can hear Harrison Ford giving this voiceover as like, what the fuck am I having to say here? It's obviously in his contract somewhere.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the thing, because, I mean, obviously, Ridley Scott fought against it hugely, but the studio insisted on it, and basically recalled Harrison Ford, because it had all been done, and they decided it needed to be done, so recalled Harrison Ford and basically, like I say, ordered him to do this voiceover. But, it, I mean, who the hell wrote it? Because it's awful. I wouldn't mind if it had actually been decent narration, but the person who wrote it, have they ever written anything in their life before? I mean, I'm assuming they are the person responsible for all the sort of shitty inspirational Facebook quotes that you get that idiots say, oh, only 1% of my friends will repost this. Yeah, because I'm not a dick, that's why I'm not reposting it.
If I don't send this to 5 family members, they will die.
Yeah, though they, to be fair, if you send that on, you deserve to die.
But yeah, I mean, that changes things so massively from what is a poetic death, and even without seeing the film, I was aware of what was referred to as tears in rain.
Yes.
You know, this was Rutger Hauer in the rain, dying, giving all this poetic stuff about how he's watched sea beams glitter in the dark and all these moments will be lost in time like tears in rain. And yet we've got Harrison Ford probably stoned giving the I don't know why he died. It's like it's like out of a bad Hallmark greetings card.
It is, it really is. It's absolutely, I mean, like the whole bit where it's like, you know, all he wanted was the answers the rest of us want. Where do I come from? Where am I going? And so I'm sure that the next bit was about Cotton Eye Joe in that bit.
And apparently the whole film crew applauded at the end of the scene.
Yeah, everyone, and you know, they carried me on my shoulders. Or their shoulders, my shoulders.
Rutger Hauer was lifted away in celebration.
Yeah, but then there's an, I mean, I've just been looking at some of the quotes where I got that bit from, and there was another bit of narration. I don't know what this is referring to, because I don't think it's Roy. But it, there's another bit. He says, "I watched him die all night. It was a long, slow thing, and he fought it all the way. He never whimpered, and he never quit. He took all the time he had as though he loved life very much." It must be Roy they're talking about. "Every second of it, even the pain. Then he was dead." It's just this amazing, sort of amazingly bad dialogue.
It's just such a weird thing to see, you know, having seen only the final cut, and then because, you know, being aware of the background of the film, going back and kind of watching-ish the original version on telly, and you just, it's just so weird seeing it. And narration is supposed to enhance a story or paint a picture, but some of the bits throughout the film seemed like they were explaining stuff that had happened ages ago, and it just seemed like they'd been dropped into random bits where, you know, sometimes, and again, it's putting it in a slightly different medium, you know, you don't always need to talk. You know, and it's something they do when they talk about cricket commentary. You need to tell people what's going on, but you don't need to, you know, let people use their imagination a little bit.
Well, it's like I remember when I used to do the Football Attic blog. I remember on one podcast we were talking about commentary, and I had watched, I think on ESPN Classic, there was an England World Cup qualifier from 1989, and we were playing Poland. And it wasn't redubbed, because a lot of those things, they just sort of got someone to redub them now as commentary. But it was John Motson and someone else. And there were great periods of the match where they just weren't talking. They were just letting the match flow, because nothing was happening, you know. So, but they weren't talking about stats, they weren't talking about anything. They weren't talking about how, you know, the central striker's mum's just had a nice birthday and got a new purple rinse or something. It was just like they were just letting the match happen and telling you what was happening when something was happening. If people were just passing it around the midfield, they just shut up, and it was great. And going back to, I think, what we were talking about earlier about not explaining everything, have you must have seen Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
And have you ever seen the director's cut of Donnie Darko?
I don't think I have, to be honest. I think I've only seen the one that we've got on DVD.
Yeah, well, don't. If you ever get the chance to watch the director's cut, don't. Because I went to see that, and it is one of my all-time favourite films. But there's a lot of stuff in it that you don't quite understand the first time around, and even the second time or third time around. There's a lot of stuff which is, it's implied, and it's a bit subtle, and you don't quite always get it. And if you watch the director's cut, it's like someone sort of hit the guy around the head with a sledgehammer and then said, right, now make this film so everyone, even you, can understand this. Because everything's, like, really literal. And you're just watching it, you're thinking, okay, I understand it a bit more, but I feel like there's no mystery anymore. It's like, you know, okay, you know, it's one of the weird things. It's like, sometimes I don't mind films where I then go and read about it somewhere else and go, oh right, that's what that meant, and that's the kind of subtext behind that. I don't mind that, but when you get that and you get this film and it's really great, and then someone, they release this version, and it's like everything is just explained in great detail, and you think, you know what, you've really lost the magic of this film now, because I might not have understood it how you intended it the first time round, but now I just feel like there's nothing about it. It's just, you've told me everything that's happening.
And one of the main other bones of contention for a lot of people is that after this part where Roy dies and Gaff has said to Deckard, it's too bad she won't live, but then again, who does? Deckard goes back to his flat and Rachel's there. And, you know, there is the, do you love me? Do you trust me? they go, and this is where Deckard picks up the paper unicorn that Gaff's left. And this is when, in the final cut, the film ends. Fade to black, yes. Credits. In the cinema version, we've got what is some footage from the opening of The Shining. And then, again, Deckard and Rachel are driving off in an open-top car towards the mansion where Jack Nicholson tried to kill his family.
The Overlook.
The Overlook, which is part of the Dirty Dancing universe, as I discovered. And then we've got more narration of Harrison Ford saying,
Gaff had been there and let her live. 4 years, he figured. He was wrong. Tyrell had told me Rachel was special. No termination date. I didn't know how long we'd have together. Who does?
And it's just like, fucking hell, man. Just let it go.
It is literally, it's so jarring. I mean, if the only version of Blade Runner ever existed was with the narration, it would just... I tell you what, that narration really does date it as well. Because it's so out of step with the rest of it. And actually, the narration itself doesn't work now. It might have worked back in the 80s. It's like when you watch like a kind of an old black and white film that, you know, everyone's at the time it was great, and then you watch it and it's like the acting's really sort of over the top.
It was a bit like an old detective film in that way, where, you know, the detective would explain, you know, what was going on as it was going, you know.
Yeah, exposition central.
Basil exposition.
And it is literally just like that. It's just, and so that because that's very sort of the time, that style of filmmaking just wouldn't sit right now. So that would really date the film.
But it's funny because for, well, at least 10 years, that was pretty much the only version that people had.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that's probably the version I actually first saw when I was about 9 or 10, but obviously I don't remember the sort of things like the narration. It probably helped when I was a child to sort of understand this strange film. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it since. And on Sky, they have Blade Runner 2049 in glorious UHD, and they have Blade Runner. And every time I keep going into it, oh, Blade Runner. And then every time I remember, it's like, no, it's the theatrical cut. And I did start watching it once, and I couldn't take more than 5 minutes. It was so awful. It's so cheesy. And it just, if you've seen the proper version of Blade Runner, it just doesn't work.
Well, this is the thing again, and I know we've covered it a lot, but for 10 years, that was the version that people had. And then there was the director's cut, and then only, what, 11, 12 years ago, the final cut came out. And again, these were huge changes to what people had seen. And, you know, we can talk about Star Wars again, but, you know, the changes that they made in those films were mostly cosmetic, mostly the addition of a bit of stupid CGI and some stuff that they cut out for pretty good reason from, you know, the whole Jabba the Hutt thing in the first film and stuff like that. You know, they were superfluous. They didn't really add a lot, but it was interesting, I suppose. But this was a whole change of pace, and it was really, even to a newcomer like myself, still really odd. But hey-ho, I'm sure someone got really rich off it. And that's the main thing.
Yeah, that's all that counts.
Yes. One thing we did very briefly mention or have done throughout the film was the soundtrack or the score to this. Now, I, again, with my complete cultural stupidity, I had always assumed that Vangelis was a classic composer, that they had, you know, I don't know, reworked his music to fit with the film or something like that. I didn't realise he was basically an early pioneer of electronica or something like that.
Oh yeah, he was the synth meister.
But for some reason, you know, and again, you know, listening to the score of the film, you know, so many bits of it I've heard elsewhere, or, you know, and it was so, it's such an imperfect tone with the film.
The weird thing about that is that music, especially something as era-defining as synth music, is something that really should date a film. You know, if you get like, I mean, if you ever watch like a film from, I mean, I was caught at the end of like Ferris Bueller's Day Off yesterday. And it's like, you know, the end bit of that where they're playing like, oh yeah, and stuff like that. And it's so dated. It's like, you know, it really is kind of, you can immediately go mid-80s, you know, sort of. And it's like, so something like that, where the whole soundtrack is nothing but synths, you think it would really date, but it doesn't seem to have done, because I think it was so otherworldly, the whole synth soundtrack. It kind of fits with that film, and it, because that film has aged well, it there are a couple of times when you hear things and it's just like, wow, that's really cheesy synth, but it doesn't seem out of place. It's an odd one, because like I say, something like that should really, really age the film.
And plus, Ferris Bueller, I'll just get this token mentioning, is a prick.
Did he exist, or was he just in Cameron's head?
Or was he a replicant?
He was a replicant.
Oh, I should have used that one for the episode.
Sorry. Oh,
fuck. But anyway, so I won't go through the usual... A lot of the usual questions that go along the line of if this movie was remade or how was it aged. I think we've pretty much covered them, and the fact that, you know, the movie was almost remade, I suppose, as a sequel. I think you've got Ryan Gosling, you know, like you said earlier, he is this... I suppose he works perfectly as a... Is he real? Is he not? You know, he does have that slightly... It sounds horrible. Vacant. He can pull off this vacant, this expression. I think anyone who's seen Drive probably go along with that. Yeah. I might have to cover that film at some point if... because for the Patreon, I'm not going to plug it, but we was planning on doing some films that are sequels, prequels to 80s films, mm-hmm. you know, or films that are set in the 80s. So I suppose that might be a good excuse to go to Blade Runner 2049 and, or is it 2049? I don't know.
I call it 2049.
Yeah.
I don't think it matters.
No one cares. People have turned off by now. Anyway, Rich, thank you so much for coming back and discussing again in the... what is hopefully the final cut of the Blade Runner podcast.
I was going to say, yeah, this will be fun out where the audio hasn't worked, or I click save and it all just bombs out and then we have to do this again.
Yeah.
Or we'll just get Harrison Ford in to narrate what we said.
He'll do a lot of things for money, as I'm sure several of the films I've seen quite recently.
Oh, well, what kind of films have you been watching recently?
I don't know.
Harrison Ford's private reel.
Yes. Make for grim viewing now that he's got an earring.
Oh dear, yes.
But Rich, now, we obviously know each other for quite a long time through the Football Attic, but you're a regular on Chris Oakley's Kit Bliss podcast. So what can people find from both your podcast appearances elsewhere and the Football Attic and your kit books?
Speaking of kit books, it's been 2 years in the works, but I'm finally at a point where I think I might actually finish my third kit collection book. Which now I can exclusively reveal has a new title. It's not even called a kit collection anymore. It's actually going to be called From All Stars to Zebras, an A to Z, or the A to Z of weird and wonderful football shirts. And it's basically because my collection since I did the second book has basically gone in the direction of collect all the weirdest football shirts possible. So it's going to be predominantly like that. So, but yeah, I've also been on Chris Oakley's Kit Bliss podcast as a regular guest. I absolutely love doing the Kit Bliss pods. Since we sort of retired the Attic a couple of years ago, it's been great to actually get back doing the podcasting again. So please do listen for those if you have any interest in football kits whatsoever. The Football Attic itself, yeah, like I say, we retired it a couple of years ago, but the sort of, you'll still sort of see me tweeting every now and again, usually a load of rubbish.
But yeah, some of those kits that I'm very much an amateur in comparison collection wise, but some of them really have to be seen to be believed. I think a lot of them probably would belong in several 80s films in some of the Hall of Shame or Hall of Fame, I don't know.
Yeah, they're just some kind of cheap horror movie.
Yeah. Have you got the broccoli one?
I have the broccoli one, yes. That's kind of... The broccoli one is where it all started, really. It's the kind of... It is the grandfather of god-awful kits.
Yeah.
But I love them.
And if you're curious, yes, it is broccoli. Google it. It's worth it.
Yeah, La Jolla Loca. It's not peas, which everyone seems to think. It's broccoli. Very, very close broccoli.
On that bombshell, I will play out the podcast, not with a narration of Harrison Ford, but with the song that was number one in the UK at the time of the film's release, which on the 9th of September 1982, Eye of the Tiger by Survivor.
Oh, wow.
Have some of that. That really should have been one of the Rocky podcasts I did, but anyway. Anyway, Rich, thank you very much for joining in.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me back on.
And I'll speak to you again for your hat trick appearance.
Fantastic. Thank you, sir.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Gary West and Fergus Higginson and associate producer Chris Oakley. You can find out more by looking at patreon.com/Betamax Video Club.